Have you ever noticed that the major events of life kind of come in bunches? When you're children, it's birthdays. Your birthdays, birthdays of cousins and friends, and there's birthday parties, and it seems like they come in bunches. Then you go on a little bit in life, get into your teen years, and soon it's graduation parties. Friends are graduating, you go to their parties, you graduate, you have your own party, perhaps, and there's graduation parties along the way. You move on into young adult years, and it tends to be weddings. You're fitted for a tux or a bridesmaid dress. You're going to stand up in somebody's wedding. Maybe a number of friends have you stand up in their weddings. Maybe you get fitted for the tux for your own wedding or your bridal gown. But it seems that they come in bunches. Then, as you move on beyond young adulthood into adulthood itself, you find that it's births. There's a baby shower going to be had. There's announcements set out. Maybe of your very own children. Seems like that happens a lot in that span of time. But then you move into your senior years, and it's funerals. Lots of funerals. At least a lot more than you'd like there to be. You find yourself reading the obits to see whether you're in there or not. Or whether any friends are in there or not. Because funerals tend to dominate the longer you live. Have you ever noticed that? That the longer you walk this path of life, the more funerals there are. The whole point of the message is wrapped up in this one simple statement today. Walking the path of life means facing many funerals. Now that works at two levels. That works at the earthly human existence level, of course. The longer you live, the more people you know are going to be dying. And we're all going to die unless Jesus comes back first. So the longer you walk this path of earthly physical life, it means facing many increasing numbers of funerals. But it also works at the spiritual level of spiritual life, whatever your chronological age. The longer you walk the path of life, the more you enter into the fullness of the life of Christ, the more funerals you have to face. And by that I don't mean necessarily actual physical deaths of loved ones or friends. Going to a church or a funeral parlor. But funerals, because something has died or must die to enter in more fully into the life that Jesus has for you. Now, I want you to take your Bible and I want you to turn to Genesis chapter 35, because today we come to the end of our study of Jacob's life. Now, Jacob's going to live on beyond chapter 35 some, but really the story begins to transition to that of his sons, and Jacob kind of fades into the background. But as we come to Genesis chapter 35, we find that in one sense, we find Jacob coming full circle. He has he's coming home again, literally. He is coming home again spiritually. He is coming back to God. He has been brought back to a fuller, deeper rest in God than he's ever really fully known before. He's brought into becoming more and more of what he ought to have been all along. And that's the description of our lives as followers of Christ. That He is progressively, ever and always, leading us down a path that is life, that is being made in the image of Christ to share in the very resurrection life of Christ. But along that way, there are some things that have to die. There have to be some funerals. Well, certainly for Jacob, it took a lot of funerals to get him to where he ought to be. And it might be that today you're facing one or more of those yourself in your journey with Christ. The story of Genesis chapter 35 is a story of four funerals and one new life. Four funerals in this chapter. I want you to look at the first one. Funeral number one was the death of old compromises. The death of old compromises. It says in verse 1, now realize we're reading this in context, that we've just witnessed in chapter 34 these atrocities that have taken place in and through the family of Jacob. It came about because he delayed his obedience to God in returning to the city of Bethel for at least 10 years. God said to him, chapter 31, arise, go to Bethel. He arose, he started that direction, he kind of oozed that direction, but he didn't take definitive steps of obedience that led him all the way to where he was supposed to go. And his family paid dearly for it, chapter 34. But now, verse 35, immediately upon this, then God said to Jacob, go up to Bethel. Do what I told you to do a long time ago. Enough of the compromises. To death with the compromises. Go up to Bethel, settle there, and build an altar there to God who appeared to you when you were fleeing from your brother Esau. He had promised God as he was fleeing from his brother Esau, and just as he was leaving the promised land, God appeared to him in Bethel, and he made covenant with him there, said, I'll be with you, I'll protect you, I'll keep you, I'll provide for you. And he said, if God will be this God to me, I will return to this place and worship him here. God had kept all of his covenant with Jacob. Jacob had not kept his vow with God. Enough of the compromises. So Jacob, verse 2, said to his household and to all who were with him, get rid of the foreign gods you have with you and purify yourselves and change your clothes. Jacob takes spiritual leadership again of his home, and he tells his whole household to three actions. First of all, he says, put away the idols that you have among you. And you say to yourself, well, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are the patriarchs of Judaism. It is a monotheistic religion, and there's only one God. What are they doing with idols in their midst? Where do they come from, and why do they have them? Well, we could guess that at least one of them, or maybe several of them, came when Rachel stole her father's false gods. Remember when they fled that foreign land to head back to the promised land? She stole some of those and kept them with her, chapter 31. Well, certainly those have been around, and maybe she didn't worship them, maybe Jacob didn't worship them. But they were around, and somebody in the family started having a fascination with them. May have been that there were other idols as well there, certainly because of their 10-year delay in obedience or compromise with the culture around them in Succoth and Shechem, where the people worshipped idols. Maybe they had acquired some there. Certainly, when they Levi and Simeon had massacred the populace of Succoth, or Shechem rather, they plundered it and took, they probably gathered up some of those false gods there. He says, enough of that. Put away the old reliances, the old trust, the old compromises. To death with them. Funeral. And he says, purify yourselves. That's the second step they were to take. Purify. It meant a symbolic ritual of washing, cleansing. It was a picture of, a confession of something else. It might even be that we could say it was the Old Testament kind of equivalent to what just happened here. Certainly not this physical water has any magical qualities about it. It doesn't wash physically anything away that's going to make you, able to stand before God. But it is a picture of what Christ has done for us and our identification in trust and faith with Him. And so they were called to say, as we're called on this side of the cross to say, I utterly and absolutely put away all old reliances, all compromises, all false gods, all idols, and I utterly abandon myself in faith to God, New Testament side of things here, through Christ, what He's done for me. And then He says, change your clothes. Not because you're wet, which I think all of those people did, to get back in, probably change their clothes into dry clothes. But here it's a symbol of a new life. You've put on something, you're walking around, your presentation of yourself, demonstration of who you are to the world around you is different now. And the Bible tells us that through Christ, that we, metaphorically speaking, are to be clothed with the righteousness of Christ. That is, that we find our sole hope before God, not in what we've done, but in what Christ has done for us. His righteousness is what prevails for us in God's presence. And He says, your sin on Christ, His righteousness on you. That's how I'll look at you from now and forever. And you are to grow into ever-increasing outward expression so that that very righteousness that's been declared over you is now demonstrated through you. So He says, do this. Away with the old compromises. Plant your feet. Come to a singular, focused, solitary trust and reliance upon God and God alone. Verse 3. Then come, he says, let us go up to Bethel, where I will build an altar to God, who answered me in the day of my distress, who has been with me wherever I've gone. That is to say, He's kept covenant with me. He kept all of His promises to me. I have not kept my vow to Him. I need to end this compromised way of living. And I want you to come with me as I do it. And I want to keep covenant with God. Verse 4, so they gave Jacob all the foreign gods they had and the rings in their ears. You say, what's wrong with that? Well, not earrings probably in the same sense that we might see people wearing earrings today. It was probably something wrapped up in the false idolatry and pagan practices. They were probably like little amulets, little charms. They were physical objects used because in some way it was thought that they had power to protect you and keep you. It was, you know, the lucky horseshoe over the door. It was the lucky rabbit's foot people carry around a rub. You know, it was superstition. Enough of that. Enough of superstitious stuff running around, trusting other things to protect and keep you. He says, let's singularly focus our trust on God who has kept us all the way down the road to this place. And it says, they gave him to him, and Jacob, look what he did. Here's the funeral. Funeral number one, he buried them under the yoke of Shechem. Verb translated buried is a kind of a fairly rare verb. It has the idea, not just simple burial, but kind of an ignominious dumping of the state. You know, we chuck these things where they belong and be done with them. And let's trust in God again and God alone. And so they had the burial. They had the funeral. And they set out, says verse 5, and the terror of God fell upon the towns all around them so that no one perceived. You know why that's important? Just think of chapter 34, at the very end of chapter 34, verse 30. What was it that Jacob was afraid of? Why did he get so mad at Levi and Simeon for slaughtering all the men in the city of Shechem? Because it was a horrible atrocity. It was morally wrong. No. Because he was afraid of the peoples of the land that they would come and they would attack and kill them. Now, that he says, when you focus yourself on trusting God alone, look what happens. It's not him who's afraid of what they'll do. It's they who are afraid of what the God who is with Jacob and his family will do to them. The fear of God came upon them. You know how much anxiety is just lifted when you just plant your feet and trust God through Christ? Not all worry. I'm not saying Christians never worry. We do, and many times when we shouldn't. But I'm saying, do you know how much lighter life can be? How much worry and fear and anxiety just melts away, and how singularly different your life can appear when you say, my trust is in the living God. Enough of the compromises. Enough of all that. Verse 6, Jacob and all the people with him came to Luz, that is to Bethel in the land of Canaan. There he built an altar and he called the place El Bethel because it was there that God revealed himself to him when he was fleeing from his brother. Very interesting thing there. Do you notice what it is? God had called him, met him all those years before. 30 years before this, God met him as he's fleeing from his brother in a place that he named Bethel, house of God. Because God came down, met him, made covenant with him, said, I'll be with you, I'll protect you, I'll keep you. And Jacob thought, this is where God must live, because I've met God here. God's come to meet with me here. The house of God, Bethel. 30 years, he's gone. 20 in discipline in the other land, in the far land. He comes back, 10 years of compromise, not yet willing to come full circle and come back to Bethel. But now finally, he rids himself, he buries, he has a funeral for those old compromises. He comes back to singularly trusting in God. Anxiety is displaced in his life. He comes back to this place where God had met him, where he vowed he'd come back to worship God. And now he calls it not just Bethel, but El Bethel. Not just the house of God, but the God of the house of God. Do you see it? The first time around, it was a very impressive thing. It was life-changing for Jacob, really. I mean, it was, I think, where he really turned his life in saving way over to God. But in many ways, it was kind of the event that dominated Jacob's mind. It was the circumstance, it was the experience of it that was so big in his mind and heart. And he'd remembered for 3 decades as he wandered about. But now that he comes back, and as soon as he plants his feet and in a singular way, trusts in God afresh, alone, old compromises gone, what happens? But that God comes to meet him again, worshiping God there, and he goes from Bethel to the experience, just the place, the circumstance, the memory, to the God of the place, the God of the memory, the God of the experience. It's not the experience so much anymore as it is the God of the experience. It's not God plus whatever equals great living. It's not God plus your dream that equals life. It is not God plus the perfect marriage partner that equals the dream. It is not God plus perfect parents that make life what it should be. It is not God plus the great job and a wonderful house and a white picket fence and a boat it'd be nice too and maybe a four-wheel drive that makes life perfect. It is God plus nothing. Jacob realized it was time for a funeral. Old compromises, this God plus living doesn't work anymore. God plus the idols, God plus the contingencies, God plus the amulets, God plus, you know, my plan instead of God's, God plus my timing rather than God's, God plus nothing. C.S. Lewis said, he who has God and everything else has no more than he who has God alone. Is it time to be done with God plus living? Is it time for a funeral? Is it time for you, at God's nudge in your heart, to deal with some old compromises? And you say, you know, I need to reduce the equation. I need to get the plus and the blank, whatever you've got in the blank, out of the way and say it's God and God alone. Because he who has God plus everything has no more than he who has God alone. What is there in your life that's been filling that blank space? Is God inviting you to a funeral for those old compromises? Second funeral, we see as we transition on to verse 8, it is the death of old comforts. The death of old comforts. Verse 8 says, now Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, who's Rebekah? Jacob's mother. Where is she? She has died. It doesn't say that. But do you realize this? That 30 years before this, she said, you have to flee for your life. Your brother's going to kill you. Partly because of the plan she helped him foist upon the father to deceive them into getting Jacob into getting the blessing of birthright and all that. Now Esau wanted to kill him, and she said, you've got to flee for your life. She said, but go. When your brother has cooled down, I will call for you, and you can return. Do you know that in 30 plus years, the call never came? He never saw his mother alive in this life again. And remember that Esau was Isaac's favorite. Jacob was Rachel's favorite. Rebekah's favorite. He was the apple of her eye. There was this amazing close affinity. And now Deborah, who was the handmaiden given by Rebekah's father to Rebekah, as she said, I will go back with this servant of Isaac to marry him in this fortnight and enter into this promise that God has given to them. This Deborah, who probably in many ways represented his mother to him, certainly in death. We don't even know when she came to join Jacob's camp, except maybe when it was Rebekah died that Deborah asked leave to go and find Jacob and live, because her whole life had really been poured into him, not the rest of the family. And she came probably with word of his mother's death and the grief that had come with that. And now she herself, even in childhood, as he's growing up, a good deal of the nurturing and the caring of his mother as would be have actually been taking place and worked through the hands and the hugs and the love and the kisses of Deborah to Jacob. And now Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died and was buried. There's funeral number 2. Under the oak below Bethel. So it was named Alon Bakuth. It's a death of old comforts. You know, in God's plan, He often pours His grace and comfort into us through other people. And I think there's a special and intimate way in which he does that through mothers to their children. Yet that is never, any of those relationships, as wonderful as it is to have God's grace come to us through those key and important relationships, whether it's mother or father or other family or through friends or through marriage with your spouse or however it may be. None of those is the ultimate source of that grace or comfort. It is God through the person. And many times those relationships fail us, hurt us. And certainly, if we walk if we walk through this world long enough, we will lose many of those relationships, at least through death. And there will have to be a transference from the secondary means through which God gives us that comforting grace to a more direct relationship and receiving from God Himself through His Word and by His Spirit that which God has previously channeled through some of those loved people, like a mother or special important people like Deborah. And so standing at Deborah's gravesite that day was for Jacob to grieve not only Deborah, but to grieve his mother and to grieve the grace and comfort he hoped to continue to get through them. Now, some of you still grieve the loss of your mother. Some of you have lost her literally through death. You've had a real definite funeral. Others of you have lost your mothers through other means, to other deaths like alcoholism. Abandonment, maybe. Maybe through mental illness. Maybe through dementia. She's not able to embrace you in your life the way she once was. And we all grieve when it comes time to transfer that trust, that expectation, that desire, that longing for comfort and grace away from mom or whoever else it may be, and begin to more directly find it from God's hand through His Word and by His Spirit. But that funeral will come. Little wonder that Jacob then named this place Alan Bakuth, the Oak of Weeping. Verse 9 says, after Jacob returned from Paddan Aram, look what happened immediately. Following that transference, that loss, verse 9, after Jacob returned from Paddan Aram, God appeared to him again. You know, how good of God to come to Jacob. How good of God to come to us. And there are some griefs for which only the presence of God is sufficient. There are no words to be said at funerals. There are no magic cards to be sent. And all of those are wonderful things we should do. But only the presence of God can meet the need. And there are some depths of experiencing God's presence that are only knowable at a gravesite. Literal physical ones, but those other depths we face throughout life as well. And what is it that God said or did to Jacob in this encounter, in his grief? It says, after Jacob returned from Paddan Aram, God appeared to him again and blessed him. Why is that important? Gather up what you know about Jacob's life. What's he been after his entire life? What has he been conniving, manipulating, grasping after working the angles to get a hold of? The blessing of God and the birthright to this promise of God that would bring salvation to the earth. He's been pursuing that and trying to wrestle that out of God and other human beings his entire life. And now God just comes to him in his grief as he progresses down the road of life and faces more and more funerals. God comes to him and he gives it to him. He blessed him. He just graced him. He comforted him. And God said to him, your name is Jacob, but you will no longer be called Jacob. Your name will be Israel. So he named him Israel. You say, well, wait a minute. Didn't God already renamed Jacob back at Peniel 10 years before. So that he said, you'll no longer be Jacob, now you'll be Israel. The night he wrestled with a man in the dark who he thought was a man, then he found out was God. And it wasn't. Yes, he changed his name then. He said, well, why does he do that again now? Well, I don't know exactly, except that that one took place outside the promised land. This one takes place inside the promised land. That one took place under the cover of dark just between God and Jacob. And now this one appears maybe to be more of a public proclamation of who he is. But remember what Israel means. Jacob, grasper, deceiver. Represents the human effort to obtain by human means and humanly wise ways the things you want. Israel means, it comes from the verb that means to struggle. Some say it means, describes one who struggles with God. Others say that it means God prevails. I think it's both and, that when you wrestle with God, God wins. And he's winning in Jacob's life. It's a long road. Lots of funerals, lots of pain, lots of difficulty. And does that sound like anybody's life who might be sitting in our presence today? But he wins. When we struggle and desire and long and grieve for the grace and mercy and blessing of God. So it says, verse 11, God said to him, now what's this sound like? Think of the history you know so far of the Old Testament at this point. God said to him, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and increase in number. A nation and community of nations will come from you, and kings will come from your body. The land I gave to Abraham and Isaac I will also give to you, and I will give this land to your descendants after you. Then God went up from him at that place where he had talked with him. That sounds very much like God is saying, Jacob, that plan, that birthright, and that blessing you wanted all along. The one I started with Abraham, remember? You know, God's great purpose, the whole Bible in one sentence. God chose one man, Abraham, so that through him he can make one great nation named Israel, so that through that nation he could bring forth the one great Savior, Jesus, so that through him God's grace could be extended and his glory demonstrated to all creation. He says, Jacob, as you die to the things of this world, as you die to the things of self, and you more singularly trust in me, you are stepping into the jet flow of the things I'm about forever and ever. And you'll find your place and your part in that. This covenant that I made with your grandfather and with your father, I'm now renewing to you. That's what he's doing there. And so Jacob set up a stone pillar at the place where he'd been talking with God, where God talked with him, and he poured out a drink offering on it, and he poured oil on it. This is an act of worship to commemorate. Say, yes, God, I am receiving what you're saying to me here, what you're giving to me. Jacob called the place where God had talked with him Bethel. He met God there. In God's plan, he designs to send his comforts and his grace to us in many ways, especially through people. But as I've said, he inevitably works in order to wean us away from the secondary means and into singularly focused trust upon the source, God himself, through his word and by his spirit. Now, we find grace and receive grace and find comfort in many relationships, family relationships, hopefully, and otherwise. And that's a good and healthy, holy thing. But as long as we ultimately trust in God through the person, not the person, in God's place. But we find other ways to manage to try to cope with life. Coping mechanisms. Comforts, if you will. Some people find their comfort in food. Eating not to live, not for strength, not for health, not in order to fulfill God's plan for me. Eating in order to deal with life. That's one way we do it. Some people do it through shopping. And you're saying, it's the most wonderful time of the year. Because you're going to shop. But you know, it's not just about the gift you're going to give. It's about the fix it gives you inside. Because there's something about shopping that does it for you. Some people do it through pursuing achievements. And just one after another, if they achieve, it just doesn't satisfy. It's not enough. It doesn't fulfill. And they keep chasing. And some people just do it through staying busy, because if they stop being busy, for goodness sake, they'd stop and hear the things rattling around inside their own head and heart, and they're afraid to deal with that. And some people cope and find comfort through hobbies and work, and some chase money and power and reputation. But in the end, they're all just coping strategies. They're all just a seeking for comfort to deal with the pressures of life. What if we relieved all of those people and all of those things of the ultimate responsibility of helping us deal with our life, and we just went singularly back to God and said, God, I believe, based on this word, that you are personal, and that by your Spirit, through your word, you can make actual in me all the things I need for life and godliness. What would that unfiltered fellowship with God, now not filtered through hobbies and pursuits and chips and dips and M&Ms and, unfiltered fellowship with God, what would that feel like? What would that do to my soul if I just said, enough of that. Enough of that. And I am going to doggedly and everlastingly plant my feet and say, death to old compromises, death to old comforts, and I am going to trust in God through Jesus Christ to meet my needs. Third funeral here, it's the death of old loves. The death of old loves. Two deaths, really, here in verses 16 to 26. One, a very literal one, and one, a figurative one. Both of them entirely devastating. First is the death of Rachel, verse 16. Then they moved on from Bethel. While they were still some distance from Ephrath, Rachel began to give birth and had great difficulty. Recall to mind several things here about the relationship in the family. Rachel was Jacob's favorite. He is the wife he always wanted. Or she is the wife he always wanted. I think I just wrote a soap opera. She is the wife he always wanted. The one for whom he said, I will labor 7 years. He fled to this far off land. He had nothing but his clothes on his back and his staff in his hand, and he had nothing to pay the bride price. He said, if you will allow me to marry her, I will labor for you for 7 years, which he did. And it says there so beautifully in Genesis that they seem but a few days to him because of his love for her. Wedding night, her father tricks him, gives Leah instead of Rachel. He wakens in the morning to, oh my goodness. He says, another 7 years. Jacob gladly works another 7 years, finally to receive Rachel as his bride. There is this desire among them for children. Rachel is unable to have children for so long. Leah's prolific and she's having children. Rachel says, here, take my handmaid, have children through her. And Leah thinks that's a great idea, so she gives the Pillsbury birth office on. And it's all going, but all the way through it, Jacob's love is for Rachel. She is the answer to his prayers. She is the apple of his eye. She is the queen of his heart. And now it says, as they moved along, Rachel began to give birth. She'd given birth. God had finally visited her, and she had Joseph. Joseph means he shall add, and she named him Joseph because she was praying that God would add another son on top of this one that God had blessed her with. And now she's pregnant again. After all these years, after all this has gone, oh my goodness, did you hear about Jacob and Rachel birth? But she's having difficulty, great difficulty, it says, verse 17, and she was having great difficulty in childbirth, and the midwife said to her, don't be afraid, for you have another son. God has answered your prayer. You said, he shall add another son. That's what you said when Joseph was born. Now, he's kept his promise. You're in the middle of a promise from God being kept. And as she breathed her last, for she was dying, she named her son Ben-Oni, son of my trouble. There was, she would receive no comfort. This is the son of my trouble. I'm dying. But his father, not letting that moniker remain and stick and rest upon him, said, "He shall be named Benjamin, the son of my right hand." Rather ironic, really, because Rachel, in the heat of the baby race with Leah, looked at Jacob before she'd had a child and she said, "Give me children or I'll die." And now he has, and she did. She said, "When Joseph was born, God has taken away my disgrace." And now that God answered the prayer that Joseph was, God has taken away her life as well. And it had to be a deep and heavy grief upon Jacob. So Rachel died, verse 19, and was buried. There's the third funeral. On the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. Over her tomb, Jacob set up a pillar. And to this day, that pillar marks Rachel's tomb. That's the literal death, the death of Rachel. Now there's, if you will, a more figurative or metaphorical death, but just as devastating. That is, I would just call the death of Reuben. He didn't die physically, but something about the relationship and the family certainly did. It says, verse 21, "Israel moved on again and pitched his tent toward Migdal Eder. While Israel was living in that region, Reuben went in and slept with his father's concubine Bilhah. And Israel heard of it." There's a great economy of words there in the Bible. A lot that's not said. Certainly, one's mind can race with filling in the gaps. But you, in all those gaps, there's these questions. Well, why? Reuben's probably in his early 20s by now. Bilhah, Rachel's handmaid. Now, Rachel's just died. Think of this. Just died. Rachel initiated in the birthing race that Jacob, she gave her handmaid Bilhah to Jacob. She bore two children for him in Rachel's place. Later then she had Joseph, and then Leah did the same thing with Zilpah. But so you've got the handmaid of the cherished precious wife who's just passed away. You've got the firstborn son of the unloved wife. Why? Lust, maybe. Probably some level, I suppose. But I think there's two other things that might be at work. One is protection. Reuben is the firstborn. He's the oldest child. And he has watched his entire life as his mother has been second best. She's longed to be the most loved. She's done everything in her power, everything humanly, everything you could think of humanly, to be greatly loved and favored by Jacob, but she has never gained it. She has always been number two at best. And he's tired of seeing that. So, lest there be some possibility that the prized wife, Rachel's concubine, might step up into her place in her absence now through death, he acts to make sure that will not happen. Maybe. In some way, perhaps protecting his mother. I think probably even beyond that is the whole idea of power. There is evidence from the ancient Near Eastern cultures around that when a son decided that the old man wasn't cutting it anymore, that he wasn't able to lead the family anymore, that something needed to change in the arrangement of how things were working, and he wanted to seize control of the family, that the son would go and would lie with, often rape, the father's concubine, or maybe even a wife, not his mother, but another wife of the father. And you see, that's weird and disgusting. Yep, exactly what it is. But if you read in 2 Samuel chapter 16, that's exactly what Absalom did when he tried to steal the kingdom from his father, David. That's exactly what Adonijah was trying to do when he requested to have Abishag as his wife so that he could displace Solomon as the one who had claimed to the throne. And so in some sense, we probably have a dissatisfied son who is grasping after power, after the blessing, after the purpose, after the promise, after the birthright, who sounds an awful lot like whom? Jacob. That there is there in the grief of what he did, the rejection, the defilement of it, the rejection, the disrespect to his father, in all of that, saying, you know, out of the way, old man, I'm taking over. But there is in all of that the deeper grief, I think, of saying, you know, the cat's in the cradle, the silver spoon. Little, he's a lot like me. I failed. It's a deep grief. If you walk long enough the road of life, you're going to find a lot of funerals. You're going to find that ones you love so dearly leave you in death, devastate you in life. And then what do you do? Well, you better have something deeper than all of that. You better have a foundation that goes far, far down below all of that. In a singular, focused relationship with God, where He can carry you. Where His grace is great enough, deep enough, personal enough, real enough, can go to so deep that it can care for those things. Now, later, of course, chapter 49, when the blessings are handed out, Jacob speaks to them over his sons. He comes to his firstborn, Reuben, and you see first in line there, he speaks and he withholds the blessing. The thing that he grasped after, the thing he demanded, the thing he tried to seize and make his own, he never got a hold of. Rather, Jacob said over Reuben, you will no longer excel. So number one was set aside. Number two, number three, Simeon and Levi, they were set aside. They did not get the inheritance. Why? Because of the massacre they undertook at Shechem. At least son number four, who is? Judah. And this purpose, this promise, this birthright, this blessing is delivered over to Judah, and through him would come King David, the line of the Davidic kings, and ultimately Jesus, who gives grace and demonstrates glory to all the peoples of the earth. There's a fourth funeral here, and it is the death of old failures. Old failures. Well, he's gone on here. I didn't read it all, but he goes on to talk about this, Jacob's 12 sons and lists them according to their mothers and so forth there. Verses 22 through 26. But now you come down to verse 27. Jacob came home. That's what it says. He's come full circle. Jacob came home. In many ways, physically, certainly, he came home to his father. But in many ways, he was coming home. He came home to his father, Isaac, at Mamre near Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had stayed. Isaac lived 180 years. Then he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people, old and full of years. And his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. Can you imagine? It's been over 30 years since Isaac and Jacob have been together. What happened the last time they were together? Old, blind, feeble Isaac thought he was already going to die. Now he's lived all this time beyond it. But in his blindness and his feebleness, his son deceived him. And yet the father blessed him anyway, knowing God's plan. Now they're back together. And you imagine the emotion that must have flooded both of them. Both now have lost their beloved wives. So much water has gone under the bridge. And though it appears in a very compressed report here at the end of chapter 35 that it's like Isaac hears Jacob's voice and drops dead or something right away. But actually, if you take all the data and put it together, it seems like they probably had 12 or 13 years together before Isaac passed. How good of God. How good of God that could happen. How did that happen? Well, it meant the death of some old failures. And old failure here is not Isaac. The old failures is the way Jacob had been dealing with Isaac. And later with his brother Esau, who at his father's death, they come together and somehow they're able to put those old failures behind them. And they live, you know, Jacob and Isaac in some reconciled fellowship for the remaining decade plus of Isaac's life, and then at his death, his brother and him come together and they're able to have a very meaningful and certainly civil, appropriate burial for the father. In all of those old failures, Jacob was able to put to death. He was able to be reconciled and at peace with father and with brother. Is there anything like that in your life? That if you're going to go on with God and you're going to walk the path of life, there need to be some old failures put to death. You know how you have a burial? You know how you have a funeral for those things? It's when you look the person in the eye and you say, I did X, Y, or Z, and I was wrong. Will you please forgive me? That's a funeral. Funerals not only have grief, there's certainly the grief, there's the gathering up of what you've done and what you've been, and you own it there. That is a deep grief. That is a death to pride, a death to self, and you die there. But you bury that, and there is the glory of the promise. There's the passing, but there's the promise in a funeral. And it is the promise that I can stand before God and man now with a clear conscience. All failures have been buried and put away. And now, chapter 36, you see that this is a long list of all of Esau's descendants and so forth. And for the most part, Esau just disappears from the scene from that point on. Really, that's what he got out of life. He was not a man who valued the birthright, the blessing, the covenant. And so this is what he got. He got a kingdom. He got Edom. And Edom shows up along the way as a bitter enemy of Israel. But that's Esau's story right there. Jacob's story lives on even today because he stepped in that jet stream of God's purpose. Not because he grabbed hold and made it his own, but he finally, through a series of funerals, just learned to trust God to bring that purpose about. And this very day, as people over here testified to faith in Jesus Christ and a new life in Jesus, Jacob's life was finding its fulfillment because the grace of God and the glory of God are going to all the peoples of the earth. But here he stands now. Four funerals, one new life. That purpose resting squarely on his shoulders. He's got a lot of stuff, but he's just one guy with an extended family and a bunch of animals, really. How is all of this going to happen through him? Did he ever get it? Yeah, he got it. I think he realized that walking the path of life means facing a lot of funerals. And that's true for us too. If we're going to ever live in the fullness of God's plan and purpose for our life, and the fullness of His grace, and the fullness of His Spirit, it's going to mean along the line we die. We die to some old compromises. We die to some old comforts. We die to some old loves. And we die to some old failures and other things besides. And we singularly rest ourselves again on God through Jesus Christ. And transfer what we've been seeking and grabbing for from all of these other places into a settled relationship of trust and faith in God through His Word, by His Spirit. Now, there's a wonderful note. It really, as I said, that the story of Jacob kind of fades from here. He's still alive for quite a while, 27 years or something like that. His sons kind of dominate the story from here on out. But he does show up at several places, and I just want to finish, if I can, real quickly, by going to chapter 47. Would you turn there? You get this wonderful. He's now an aged old man. So much has gone on. There's been more funerals. There's been more pain. It's been difficult. His sons deceived him because of their hatred for Joseph, and they threw him in a pit, and they sold him to Egypt, and they told his dad he was dead. He rises to become a powerful guy who delivers Egypt out of famine, and his family back in the promised land is starving and goes through this whole scenario. His father thinks he's dead. The father grieves. Then the father has to send off Benjamin and risk him dying in order to get more food. And so all this has transpired. And finally, the whole plan is unfolded. Famine has come. Joseph's made himself known. He brings his entire family down to Egypt now, where they're going to enter into a long period when their numbers multiply greatly and they move toward becoming that great nation. But here we come, and now it says, verse 7, chapter 47, then Joseph brought his father, Jacob, in where? Into the presence of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Now get this. Here's Jacob. He's a shriveled old man in old shepherd's clothes. He's got, you know, a bunch of sheep and goats and a number of sons. But really, in the grand scheme of things, he doesn't look like anybody. He'd look like you or me. We'd look less than him, I'm sure. And he's going into the presence of the most powerful and most wealthy man on the planet. Verse 7, then Joseph brought his father Jacob in and presented him before Pharaoh. After Jacob, listen very carefully here, catch it. After Jacob blessed Pharaoh, Pharaoh asked him, how old are you? Jacob said to Pharaoh, the years of my pilgrimage are 130. My years have been few and difficult. A lot of pain. A lot of funerals. They do not equal the years of the pilgrimage of my fathers. Then Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Wait, who blessed who? The guy who apparently has nothing at all? Withered old stinky shepherd man with almost nothing in the world? Blessed the man who resides in glorious splendor and possesses more power and wealth than anybody on the planet. And who blesses who? And what was it Jacob chased his entire life? What is it the grasper was grasping after, working the angles to get, wrestling, trying to get out of God and man? All along it was the blessing. Through a series of funeral, God brings him to the end of himself where he finally abandoned himself in faith on God alone and his purpose and promise of salvation. And he receives the thing he's been grasping after by his own works all along. He receives by grace as a gift. And now at the end of his life, though apparently in worldly terms he doesn't have much of anything at all, he stands before the guy who seems to have everything in the world. And he says, you know what? God has blessed me. And I got way too much here. In fact, it's really hard to just carry it all around inside my heart. You know, why don't you just take some of it? Here, have some. It just keeps coming. And every time I pull some out and give it to somebody, it just keeps filling back up. Take some of this blessing that God keeps flooding my life with. How do you get your life that full? Series of funerals. Old compromises, old reliances, old allegiances, old love, old comforts, old failures. Singularly, resting yourself upon God and His promises through the person of Jesus. That is the path of life. Let's pray. Our Father, it is not easy. Never has been. Don't expect it will be in this life. Jacob was right. Our years are too few to get the stuff we want in the way we're going about it. And they're too hard for us to endure on our own. Too much pain, too much loss, too much grieving, too many deaths. So Lord, we give it up. And we choose to believe you through your Son, Jesus. We trust you to provide for us the things that we have been grasping after all our lives. Grant them to us by grace. Make the blessing so large that there's great excess to be given away to every person we meet in whatever way we can. Let us live in that, and we will have found the path of life. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.